B2B influencer marketing. Is it a thing? It almost sounds counterintuitive, but I would argue that B2B brands have more to gain from leveraging influencer marketing than consumer-facing brands do. And today, I literally have the king of B2B influencer marketing as my guest on this next episode of the Your Digital Marketing Coach podcast.
Digital, social media, content influencer, marketing, blogging, podcasting, vlogging, TikToking, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, SEO, SEM, PPC, email marketing. Whew! There's a lot to cover. Whether you're a marketing professional, entrepreneur, or business owner, you need someone you can rely on for expert advice. Good thing you've got Neil on your side. Because Neil Schaefer is your digital marketing coach. Helping you grow your business with digital first marketing, one episode at a time. This is Your Digital Marketing Coach, and this is Neil Schaefer.
Hey everybody, Neil Schaefer here. How the heck are you doing? I hope you enjoyed my previous episode number 312, where I talked all about how live streaming changes everything. That episode was really, really important to me, that I tell you my latest thoughts, my latest experiments. And today is going to be another episode that was also live streamed. I am now, whether it is a solo episode or a guest interview, these are being live streamed. Hey, I love podcasts just like you do. I do not consume podcasts through video, but if you wanted to get a chance to engage with the people I'm interviewing or engage with me while I'm recording and actually get your questions answered, I urge you to check out, if you go to youtube.com/Neil Schaefer, there is a live tab. In the live tab, you can see all of my upcoming live streams. So you could join, you could say hi, you could also ask a question. I have two specific live streams coming up. You've already missed a bunch, to be honest with you. I have Andy Lambert, who is formerly of Content Cal, currently works at Adobe on their Adobe Express team. He is also the author of Social 3.0. And what's really relevant to what we're going to be talking about is he believes that social media is the best way to achieve growth for B2B brands going forward. So that's going to be a great one. I also have my friend Viper. Viper is, that's V-Y-Y-P-R. He is the man about tech. He is also the social media director for VidIQ, one of the top YouTube tools. And we're all going to talk about podcasters leveraging YouTube. If you're on YouTube, why don't you have a podcast? If you have a podcast, why aren't you on YouTube? Live streaming changes everything, right? So go check that out. You can also find other interviews that I've done that I've yet to publish on the podcast. Hint, hint. I'm currently first recording the live stream, then recording the podcast. So it also gives you a sneak peek of what's coming in the podcast should you want to check it out. So once again, youtube.com/Neil Schaefer. You might need to put the at mark in front of my name, because YouTube started this system of handles. And then if you go to /streams, you'll be able to actually get notified. There's a little notify me button that you'll be able to get notified for my future live streams if you are on YouTube. All right. Well, today's guest is one of those special guests. I know when I begin the interview, I'm going to be interviewing him as well. If you follow me on social media, you'll know that I was in London for an event back in early November of 2022. That event was for B2B influencer marketing put on by Analytica. I'm interviewing Tim Williams, the CEO of that company, and he's going to be back in San Francisco doing an American version that I'm excited to be part of, to be on a panel on as well. So I want to just jump in. I know that you're going to love this episode. And even if you're not in B2B, these concepts apply to B2C as well. So keep listening. Let's do it. Here's my interview with Tim Williams, CEO of Analytica.
You're listening to Your Digital Marketing Coach. This is Neil Schaefer.
Tim, welcome, my friend.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here because I heard you talk about B2B influencer marketing probably 2015, 2016, or some kind of way back when in San Diego. the sort of social media marketing conferences. So now to appear on your podcast, I'm truly honored. So thank you.
No, and I remember that. And I remember you challenged me because obviously you've built a technology company and the role that technology can have in influencer marketing. At the time, I was like, let's dumb it down. Let's everybody get on the same page as to understanding the concepts. And then obviously, if you want to scale your program, you need that technology, right? So I know we're going to cover both ends of the spectrum today. But Tim, that was sort of my way of looking at Analytica. I know that you have a past even before Analytica that sort of gives you your unique perspective on this B2B influencer marketing. So I want you to tell your story. I mean, how did you get involved in all this and in launching Analytica and B2B influencer marketing? What happened before that professionally that made you see that this was a huge area that needed this company?
Yeah, well, thanks for sort of allowing me to go back into the, you know, how it started. I mean, really from 2003, I was looking at how, you know, individuals, practitioners could lobby or influence your certain target audiences, but through influencers. So in 2003, it was really looking at lobbyists trying to influence politicians. And then when I was looking, you're more around sort of 2008, 2009, it was looking at how PR professionals can lobby journalists. So looking at sort of media databases. And then just I naturally went, you know, on to social media and ran about, you know, 2006, I think, sort of Twitter came out. Obviously, Facebook was in its infancy. And, you know, 2012 to 2014, I was just seeing that there were social media influencers or indeed websites that were being very, very influential at the time. And I wanted to extend the expertise I had, you know, with lobbying politicians or trying to influence journalists into social media influencers. And I just was really excited by the scale of social media because politicians, you know, if you're talking about trying to influence the Senate in the US or maybe Parliament in the UK, it's still quite a small niche of people. If you're looking at journalists, people might have like 40 or 50 journalists that they're trying to influence. But when you're looking at social media influencers, sometimes you think you're looking at sort of tens of thousands of influencers in one particular topic. So it was an extension of what I was doing, but it just excited me the actual scale of which, you know, people could sort of tap into that creator economy.
And Tim, would you agree? Yeah, we now call it the creator economy, right? Obviously, back in 2015, that didn't exist. But I think this is one of the challenges that people have with influencer marketing in general. When you think of a politician's influence, and when you think of a social media influencer influence, it's at a different scale, but yet there is still influence. And going back to the B2B example, if that person is influencing really, really key people within an organization, maybe not in the millions or tens of thousands or even thousands, even hundreds, there is still influence at play there. So I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I think it's a major opportunity and still a problem, you know, with organizations. How do you define an influencer? In fact, I went through London just interviewing random people that I stopped on the street saying, who do you think an influencer is? And of course, everyone on the street says, oh, it's someone with an Instagram account with millions of followers because they think of the celebrity. But of course, in B2B, when people say influencers and people who are running influencer marketing programs talk to their senior management saying, should we get an influencer? It's too ambiguous. And I think a lot of people are struggling with that. So I think that, as you said, you know, if you influence 10 people and those 10 people influence another 100 people and those 100 people influence another 200 people, maybe you are driving a lot of market share in your particular industry. It doesn't have to be your tens of thousands. But I also think what's at play here is actually trying to segment people or categorize people into terms that people understand. If you say, should we bring some event speakers to talk about this wonderful topic? Everyone understands what you're saying. If you say there's an industry expert who's, you know, talking about the metaverse, like, would you like us to bring them in for them to share their expertise? People understand that. When you say, hey, should we work with a social media influencer? Like, no one knows what that is. People have more reference to a blogger or someone who specializes in LinkedIn Live. So I think there's a major problem. And I think technology and what we're trying to solve naturally is how to create a taxonomy, how to create categories where people can say, oh yeah, that's a perfect person for what we need. Because influencer marketing can be, like you say, just trying to influence five people, or you could need to influence, you know, a couple of million people. And so there are very many different influences. And I don't like the word macro or micro or nano. You know, I think it's a B2C one. I personally hate those terms because
Agreed. All
people are saying is, you know, people with large or, you know, large follower bases or small follower bases. And what we know in B2B is it's so much more nuanced than that. It's really intellectually stimulating to work in the industry, but it's much more simple if you're in B2C to say, drive this much engagement, let's see how many product sales happen. But as we know, buyers in B2B aren't always buying, you know, at any one time. And there can be 15 to 20 people who influence that. And it can be over a 6 to 12 month, maybe 18 to 24 month cycle. So it becomes really nuanced and really complex. So I think, how do you define influence and, you know, who is an influencer is still, you know, a massive challenge in the industry.
Yeah. And when I wrote The Age of Influence, I try to simplify that because with B2C, and we could say content creators, it's social media content creators that have large followings. And then how large is their following, how much impact they have, what's their niche, et cetera, et cetera. With B2B, though, those terms like the event speaker, the tech blogger, the expert, you know, there still are expert journalists at certain media companies that are still influential, right? And then obviously the employee, the internal influencer. These are, when I went to your event in London, everyone's like internal influencer, external influencer. But when you think about it, and when I wrote the book and sort of connected the dots to my past, I realized that influencer marketing has always been part of B2B brands, B2B marketing, including the customer as influencer, right? Wouldn't it be great if we could get this customer to speak at our event because we know that they're going to influence everyone in the crowd, for instance. So I think with B2B, actually, once people understand what's at play and how, why don't we create a program? And really the topic of today is all about this B2B influencer program. If we can create a program that brings these people together in an always on fashion, not just because we have an event, but how can we sort of collaborate? I used a YouTube thumbnail, you know, B2B influencer collabs, because I wanted to paint it in the same picture. It is a collaboration. It has to be a win-win for both parties. So I guess, Tim, why don't we start? I sort of painted this broad and you had begun this you know, canvas of painting this landscape, which I've tried to add to. When we think of B2B influencers, who should that include? How far can we go in our definition? Why don't we begin there?
Yeah, I think when we work with brands, we start with, you know, event speakers, industry experts that have the expertise. We also look at people who are customers. I think you've mentioned that, and that's a really, really key persona as well. Some brands like Cisco are doing amazing work linking up customers and external influencers and really making it part of their customer advocacy program. So I think customers is a really key part. I think there's also sometimes brand employees, it could be people that work for professional service brands that are actually employed by them, but they also are now doing speaking gigs or they're getting paid your creator opportunities. So I think, you know, there's also people that working for large enterprise brands that would never call themselves influencers, you know, who are now, you know, very, very expert and can be leveraged. And then, of course, there's your internal subject matter expert as well. So I would say that it helps to start there. You've obviously got the analysts and the journalists. And what's really interesting is that that there are more and more independents. And, you know, analyst relations is coming over more and more to sort of B2B influencer marketing. And so is PR as well. So I think a lot of the disciplines are sort of, you know, blending, and there's a few gray areas. I know that there's lots of brands that, you know, find that there's three different teams managing one particular influencer because they're a journalist, they're an analyst, they're an influencer, and they have many different hats here. So I would say that, you know, everything is blurring, and it's really, really important to reach out to individuals to find out, you know, how they can help and to keep an open mind.
So because businesses have been doing this without calling it influencer marketing, they have these aspects of influencer marketing in these activities across the organization, the ROI then of these activities is very clear. And I suppose if you can bring them together under one umbrella with a dedicated budget and dedicated measurement, you can now begin to really figure out and measure in more exact terms what that ROI is. Is that a correct assumption to make?
Exactly. And I think when you look at ROI, some people look at leads and just talk about, you know, the actual revenue you can generate from creators. And so if you're doing that, then you then we have seen results of up to five times demand gen when you're looking at the kind of content. It could be a webinar, for example, to bring in external influencers, and then you look at, you know, how much more you're driving, you know, with influencers involved, or it could be some gated content. So it can be as simple as that. Or it can just be creating some quality content, but then you're trying to use that content, break it down into multiple social assets and build it into your existing demand gen activity. So that could be, say, an email marketing campaign that you're trying to drive leads from. So it can be leads, and a lot of people use it for top of the funnel awareness. And we're seeing up to 30 times, you know, awareness and engagement on social compared to brand generated content. So those are the two main ones. But I think what is fascinating about this kind of tactic is that there's lots of intrinsic value as well, because the actual content is just far more interesting. And then when brands produce this content, a lot of employees want to share it because it's the most interesting content, because it's not necessarily talking about the brand, it's talking about the expertise and the thought leadership stuff. So you get lots of kind of indirect benefits. And actually, it's more cost effective to create the content. I think gone are the days where you need to spend $30,000 or $40,000 on lots of research. You can actually reach out to influencers and get their opinions and quotes and build the research while, you know, showcasing the influencer's talent. And that's just a very different route to market. And I think the people that understand that, the people that make the influencers or employees the heroes of their content, can create much more cost-effective content. So I think there's ROI to be had all the way throughout. But of course, a lot of people are looking for leads, for example, or, you know, social awareness.
That's a great point about what in the B2C world we call UGC, user-generated content, that when you use user-generated content throughout your marketing, whether it is on your organic social, your paid advertisements, in your shopping cart, on your website, that it tends to have a greater ROI. It tends to really raise the boats of everything else in the ocean from a marketing perspective. And there is that cost, right? We know, you know, the Content Marketing Institute every year puts out these numbers. The amount of B2B marketing budget that is invested in content is, I think on average, what, like 30, 40%. It is a really, really big number. And I say the same thing with B2C. You could be potentially saving a lot of money and having better content. And then to your point, when you have better content and your employees want to share it, you really get this amazing exponential benefit from that. So just as when I talk to companies that might be a little bit, you know, they're not, they don't think they're ready for influencer marketing. Like, okay, well, let's look at influencer marketing for content creation, for generating user-generated content. Then I think companies look at it in a very, very different way, and they begin to see the ROI of it. So that's a really, really great point. And hopefully, I mean, I know we're going to talk about the San Francisco event at the end, but hopefully that's a point. I think in B2B influencer marketing, that content is something that really has not been brought up as much as it should as one of those benefits of the ROI.
I completely agree. And what's fascinating is when you go to events and, you know, when, say, you and I speak at events about B2B influence marketing, it's normally introduced as, you know, this is one of the new go-to-market strategies. And I think you hit the nail on the head by saying, you know, people have been doing this for decades. They just might have been doing it with one or two people. This is about how to create a program at scale. So how to create an army of content creators who is your community, who drives much better impact, better business impact. And that's looking internally at your employees, who are your best assets, but also externally with your influencers. Bringing them together, having that community, is a program at scale. And obviously, to go from, you know, leveraging one or two people, not even knowing or thinking that you're doing influence marketing to that particular community, is quite a big stretch. You know, it might take, you know, anything from 6 months to 2 or 3 years. But I think that's where the real magic happens.
Yeah, after I was pre-selling The Age of Influence, I had a brand director from a big consumer CPG brand, their APAC headquarters in Singapore, reach out to me. So I actually went down, visited his company in Singapore, met with the brand managers there. And he said, Neil, we have all of these, he called them nano influencers, sorry, but he, you know, we have all these, you know, smaller influencers in terms of follower count, And they all love our brand. But you know what? They're not the best copywriters. They're not the best photographers. They're not the best videographers. What do you think of us bringing in an influencer that's really good at copywriting, at photo video? What do you think of us bringing in an influencer to train these other influencers? And I thought that was just a fantastic idea. And I see these synergies that could be had when you bring together external and internal of all of the core expertise that people in that group have. And when they work together, the synergy, and it's all related around the brand that brought them together, right? So you're naturally building more loyalty and more advocacy. And so when I talk about bringing people together, and I'm sure you'd agree, there's just so many benefits that can be had. It seems counterintuitive. Why would I want my customers and my employees and external, and why would I want them all together in one program? But have you seen, Tim, in, you know, working with many brands, and I know that this is still a relatively new idea. I don't know how many brands are doing this yet in B2B, but have you seen examples of this in action?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we've done research, you know, there's about 85% of B2B brands are doing a bit, but really, really do believe in this particular tactic. But less than 50% are actually doing something about it. I think there's a lot of brands, you know, needing to start, but are wondering where to start. And I think the interesting challenge that they have sometimes is, you know, they don't have the confidence to bring together that community around one topic if they don't feel like they've got the best expertise or all of their subject matter experts lined up. And what sometimes we say to them is that's okay. You know, you can obviously have a stance on it. You can bring all these content creators and you can make them the heroes and obviously so publish lots of content. And then you can go on that journey with them. But I think that's where some people, you know, don't get that massive community together of employees, your influencers and customers. And the other part is really just having the ability to bring all these programs together. The companies that we work with who have less than 5,000 employees actually have a central team that is in charge of digital and social, might be, you know, able to contact the customer advocacy person and can kind of work across these particular silos. When you're a massive tech company that might have 100 to 300,000 people, sometimes it's owned by different people. It's very hard to get that community and to be able to have the remit, you know, globally to be able to achieve that. But yeah, we're seeing, you know, wonderful brands like SAP, IBM, you know, Ericsson, you know, Cisco, you know, many tech brands that are bringing communities together and really looking at what the community is interested in, is motivated by. They're feeding insights into the community. They do have some pay-to-play, some ongoing retainers with some of the professional influencers. The industry experts, they're not on a pay-to-play basis, but they're obviously driving value for them. And some of them have communities of upwards of, you know, 80 to 100 people. A lot of the brands have maybe 10 to 25 or 10 to 30 that they've nurtured over the past 1 to 2 years. So it really differs in terms of the scale. And of course, it differs in terms of the regions, because a lot of our US clients are doing, you know, US stroke global influencers. But obviously, when you're working with France or the UK or Germany or Spain, for example, it tends to be in that country that they focus on. And they don't tend to activate the US influencers if there's a US counterpart. So I think at play here is also who owns the program internally, because there's a lot of ownership when you're in a company and you make a name for yourself in influence marketing, and there might be sort of 10 other people around the world that might be doing influence marketing, then it's really important to collaborate. And I think we're just seeing which companies are doing that better or not, just depending upon how they're set up.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a proud Adobe Express ambassador, and Adobe, under NDA, I can't give any details, but they're doing an amazing job of building a community, bringing the community together for physical events, and community members actually teaching each other their niche skill sets just for community members. So it all just builds, like I said, more loyalty for that brand and more advocacy. So Tim, based on everything you've been talking about, I want to get to this concept of B2B content creator, because this is something that, when I saw you last in London just 4 months ago, I don't think anyone mentioned that word, but I think today it's becoming more common. But before we get to the B2B content creator, we talk about internal and external. If a company is listening to this and they've yet to get started with a formal program and they had to choose internal first, external first, Is there a direction that you would recommend, all things being equal?
I've never been asked that question before. I love it. So I'm thinking on my feet. I think your best assets are your internal assets. So if you've got the subject matter experts, if you've got the internal influencers, then I think leverage them first. Because you employ them, because they're really important to you, and they're going to be so useful. I don't think it tends to be an either or. I think if you're looking internally, you can then connect up to a few external influences. So you could over-index on your employee advocacy program, but then bring in one or two external influences, and that's probably how I would go for it. If your internal executives or subject matter experts are not really out on social and sort of need a lot of work, and I think you need that business impact, then I would go external first. And why I would do that is because the external influencers have sometimes spent 10 to 15 years building up their engaged network. So they are experts in what they do. They've got a very engaged audience. So if you connect them to an executive who might not be on social media at all, not have the confidence to be able to be on there, you can create a video interview just like this. And then you can break down the actual video interview into multiple different quotes, into social audio, into you know, snippet video pieces. You can obviously go live on different platforms just like you do. And you can actually sort of build up that executive through your external influencer program. So I think you've really got to look at the objectives. You know, what do you need to achieve? And then look at where your best assets are. If they're not internally, go externally. And I think each of the programs can benefit the other. But we see that the larger the organization is, the more challenging it is to link up these two particular programs. And so I think the wonderful opportunity is when you're a startup, SMB, when you've got up to 1,000 employees, it's an amazing opportunity to be able to do this much faster than a really large enterprise. And also when you're a challenger brand, all the challenger brands are trying to go much faster, trying to beat the competition, get ahead of who's the market leader. And I think this kind of tactic really serves a lot of benefit in trying to sort of leapfrog your competitors, because if they haven't got that community of content creators, you can quite soon get greater mind share than the market leader. And then obviously that should translate into market share thereafter.
Yeah, absolutely. Seen that time and time again, the aggressive startups in everything they do, and whether it's influencer marketing, content marketing. And yeah, I mean, I agree about going internal first. I always have this pyramid of brand affinity, right? Always start with people that have the most like, know, and trust for your brand. And obviously those are going to be your employees. But if you already have existing external relationships as well, obviously they already have that like, know, and trust. So that's great advice. So we talked about the B2B content creator. And if we're going external, we are basically working with B2B content creators. Well, customers may not be, but a lot of external, there might be bloggers, YouTubers, podcasters, what have you. I want to talk about the internal B2B content creator, because most employees are not B2B content creators. Yet in order to really, reap the benefits of a program, if somehow we can get our employees involved in the content creation, we know that it could be really, really powerful. I have seen Microsoft has something called an autonomous video booth. Any employee can walk into this booth, and it has video cameras, microphones. It has this automated system that leads you through, and you can just tell your story, and you leave, and you have a video that now you could upload, or that Microsoft can upload. And it's just this fantastic idea. I believe they started doing this right before COVID. I've never heard of any other B2B brand doing this, but how do you, in a similar way, how do you foster this culture, or how do you help employees become B2B content creators, I guess is the question, knowing that that could really benefit any type of program?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. We would segment employees, first off, because I think there's so many different personas, and they have different techniques to be able to sort of help them, to leverage them, to help them with their own personal brands, and to get them motivated to sharing content. So we break it down into executive leaders. They have intrinsic value to your brand impact. And so they typically either are on social media or should be, or have people to manage their profiles. So that's one segment. Then there's the salespeople. And a lot of people are involved in sort of social selling and are you're obviously using LinkedIn and Sales Navigator and tools like that to be able to contact prospects. And then you have the subject matter experts, which are this kind of forgotten middle, where these are your internal thought leaders. And these are the people that are naturally, you know, tend to be sort of head of business unit, or you know, people that are talking about specific topics that you know, bubble up in the organization. I think that is the kind of magic segment we're talking about. And then, of course, there's the other employees. And the other employees tend to be targeted by an employee advocacy tool. So you know, a lot of brand content is put into that, industry content is put into that, and employees, you know, go through social training programs. And I think those are great and they work to a certain level. But as you say, like anything, you know, like Microsoft, you know, creating that booth, it enables people to become content creators when they really don't feel like they are. So those other employees, I think, are catered for, you know, for the employee advocacy tool, but clearly you're being able to understand the employees and what they need and to help them get to the next level is key. Where we focus on, and so what I can speak to, is more the executive leaders and the subject matter experts. I think that some of the subject matter experts are already out there. They're differentiating themselves and they just want help to become more influential with an external voice, because quite often they're getting lots of internal collaboration and some external impact, but they're really looking to get to that next level. So being able to link them to external influences is a really motivating way for almost to have like a VIP program, so that when they get to a certain level, you can connect them to people who are externally influential and can take them to the next level. I think they're also executive leaders that are great one-to-one. You know, we're talking to people in the marketplace, but they're not confident on social. So I think that being able to create a program where executive leaders can do what they feel comfortable with and then turn it into social media content is really, really key. So this is where the program managers or the executive comms or assistants really need to be able to enable them to get to that next level. So, for example, there could be a general manager of a really large company doing a one-to-one you know, video interview and then getting help on how to break that down into a social media post. When they speak to 20,000 people on that social media post rather than the 100 people they'd spoken to the previous day, they suddenly have that light bulb moment and they suddenly start investing more in social. There was one other example, if I could give it, a really wonderful example from Ericsson, where one of their evangelists, who was really smashing it on social media, spoke to another employee and buddied up with him to say, just give me 20 seconds of your time and let's create a video together. Asked him one or two questions, recorded that, and then posted on social media and tagged him, and then suddenly helped him build his following, you know, through really having sort of a buddy system on their kind of employee advocacy program. So now subject matter experts can start spreading their influence and helping other subject matter experts. So I think when you come to the execs and subject matter experts, it's no one size fits all. I think it's understanding the different personas, where people feel confident with, what their motivations are. And because it's more nuanced like that, it's quite hard to scale, but it requires a mix of executive coaching, custom webinars, e-learning, and also the right program culture to be able to encourage people to really go for it.
Yeah, that's an amazing. Thank you so much. You've basically created this architecture for what the program, at least from an internal perspective, should look like. I love that dividing out of beginning with executives. Always said, you know, when you look at who has the most to gain from an influencer marketing program, it's definitely the executives or maybe the salespeople, because they can monetize their influence in a weird way with B2B. But yeah, and then in between there, depending on, you know, the technology, if you have employees that are speaking at events about the technology, for instance, and obviously those are subject matter experts that are already out there. How do we then convert them into becoming part of this program? You also mentioned for all of the other employees, employee advocacy. So in other words, they're not going to be so much B2B content creators, but how do we get them to participate? So I'm curious, before we live stream, you mentioned that, you know, one of the things you want to talk about is how to connect this influencer marketing program that you just described with an employee advocacy program. And I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. So when I talk about that, that tends to be more the subject matter experts connecting that with the influencer marketing. program. But if you're thinking about wider employees, then I do think that when you create influencer marketing content and you've got these real, you know, amazing personal stories that influencers are telling, and it's really relatable content, I think making that available, you know, in the employee advocacy tool, but encouraging employees to put their own take on it is really, really key. Because, you know, I speak to executive leaders, I speak to, as I put it, other employees, which, you know, is not a very nice term, but it could be anyone from marketing, it could be HR, it could be anyone from any team that just doesn't fit into sales or they're kind of subject matter experts. And all of them say that they don't want to just sell the company. They want to share content about social purpose. They want to share content that they're proud of, but they don't want to say, you know, Microsoft is better than SAP or SAP is better than IBM or anything like that. Even the sales leaders don't want to say that.
Right.
You know, no one wants to share that kind of content. So I think, how do you connect influencer marketing to the broader employee advocacy tool? I think it's about repurposing that content into the tool and making it shareable, but you don't want 5,000 people sharing exactly the same article, because then they stop doing it because you seem like the rest. So being able to encourage them to tell their own story, to tag certain people in, to really, you know, enable you to reach different audiences is the key component in what an employee advocacy program manager needs to do to leverage the content.
Excellent advice. I want to switch gears a little bit. Make sure we're obviously covering a lot of territory here, but I want to make sure that the listener just has all of their questions in their mind answered. So we talked a lot about the internal. I want to shift now to the external. You obviously, you're fostering your own community of external influencers. I'm part of your community, and anybody listening that is a B2B content creator should definitely join the Analytics community, and you can ping me or Tim afterwards to find out what that is. But I want to flip the script. So I'm a B2B brand, and it's like, great, I already got the internal piece going. I want to invest more in the external piece. We've never really worked with external influencers. What are the things that external, you know, B2B content creators, what are the things that they look for when a brand reaches out to them? In other words, how can brands be successful with external B2B influencers? How should they position, you know, what advice would you give? Because I'm sure you've seen amazing success stories and then horror stories that these influencers tell you when we meet up at a pub in London when no one's listening. So, you know, what are sort of the best practices in reaching out to B2B, you know, creators, understanding, you know, what their needs and wishes are?
Sure. And I can't share everything that we talk about in a pub in London, of course. So
what happens in London stays in London, right?
Exactly. So we did some research in 2020 to ask the influencer community what they look for when they're working for brands. And, you know, of course, the professional influencers that do it, you know, are professional creators, and they do it, you know, for a living. Then they're not employed by anybody else. You know, it is important for them to get monetary work. So that's clearly important. But even the professional influencers, you know, they said that, you know, 72% of them said that they would work with a brand, you know, without being paid a fee if they believed in their product or their purpose. So it might be linked to a certain foundation that they're associated with. And they also would be happy to work with a brand just to create the initial relationship, because they might not know each other. So it's not always about money, which is a misconception, especially in the States. And I think in Europe, it's sometimes been more organic and then paid, whereas in the States, it's been much more sort of paid straight away and then thinking that no one would work organically. So that extends there's a question into, you know, what other things might influencers be interested in? And they're really interested in industry insights. So if they're topical experts, they want case studies, they want to speak to customers, they want access to senior execs. So a lot of the professional influencers that see themselves as independent analysts, and also being linked to the analyst community, means that they get paid more. So interesting that's another thing going on in the industry about what they call themselves. So they're looking for insights as well. When it comes to reaching out to influencers, what creators or influencers really hate is when a brand says, hey, we want you to say this. Can you publish this on your social profile? Because I know you're influential. 70% of the influencers who had input into the brief on what content they were creating, deem their campaigns to be extremely successful. And that's probably one of my best pieces of advice, that if you go to a creator or an influencer, sure, you can have a rough brief to say, hey, we're looking to sell some registrations for our event. I'd love to work with you because I know you're an expert, you're in this particular field. But don't tell them, we want exactly this piece of content with exactly these 10 messages, because no creator wants to work with you, on that basis.
It's so funny, because the reason why these people have influence is through the content that they create, the message. They know how to craft a message that engages an audience. And when a brand just asks them not to use their own message, but to use the brand message, it totally goes against how they became influential in the first place, right? And smart brands would say, I want to tap into how that creator messages the community. That's going to obviously provide more engagement. So I'm always fascinated when I hear about brands that just don't get that. It's just extremely counterintuitive.
I think it still goes on so much because the people who are running the programs get it, but the people who they're speaking to internally don't give them that creative freedom. And because they're maybe sometimes sold in as, we're going to work with some influencers in inverted commas, and they don't know exactly what that is. Sometimes you get people saying, okay, well, I want to make sure that it's on message, and I want to make sure that it's in line with all of the brand values. And sometimes I say to them, the great thing is that it doesn't have your voice.
Yeah.
It isn't, because when I was speaking to a global tech firm that was working with a TikToker talking about how wonderful it is to work with their brand, they could never have created the content that this TikToker did. If they're given those brand guidelines, the TikToker wouldn't have done it. It wouldn't have been successful. Now, of course, don't necessarily go live straight away with someone that you don't know or don't trust yet.
Of course.
But the more creative, like you're saying, the more creative you can be, the more open to experimenting with this, I think the more impact you'll get.
And the analogy I give for this is, let's say you have an idea or a message, type that into ChatGPT and look at the amazing variations and the creative messages that you can make that you had never thought of before. And I look at working with influencers, it's the exact same way. They're going to provide, but their messaging is tested with their communities though, which is even better. So when you think about it that way, the more you control that message, actually the fewer people you're going to be able to engage and the less successful you become. So it's just a very, very interesting paradigm that we have out there. So I want to move on to, I want to ask you a question based on what you were saying. So you were saying in Europe, you see a lot of organic moves into paid, but in the United States, you see it the opposite. And I'm just curious, I have my own theory about why that might be, but I'm curious as the role of the agency in influencer marketing, especially in B2C. I believe that a lot of influencer marketing spend at the beginning was primarily done through agencies, and I'm talking B2C as well. I'm curious from a B2B perspective what you see, because B2B brands also work with agencies, right? I'm curious if that has, because agencies, they need to activate so many people for a campaign, and therefore it sort of means they almost have to pay to make sure that they hit those numbers and they deliver. Do you think that has influenced influencer marketing and becoming more paid than it necessarily has to, if the brand can directly have some communication with the influencer?
Yeah, I think that's it's a fantastic point that is not talked about too much. Who it is who asks the influencer to create some content dictates how the influencer answers. If a student says, hey, could you create some content? Then the influencer is not going to say, hey, $10,000 to be able to do this. If a global tech brand says, hey, do you want to create some content? Then a lot of the creators, the professional creators, will think, okay, well, how much can I charge for this? Because it's still a bit like the Wild West. We publish a compensation guide, but there's still people charging different amounts in the same, even when working with the same company, in different regions. So it tends to be, it's not normalized. So I think when agencies reach out, I think it's always a paid opportunity. Always a paid opportunity. I think when brands reach out in-house, when they're trying to build a community and the community is of high value, then they can engage organically. But it needs that investment into the program, you know, from the brand. So you're investing somewhere, right? You know, whether it's in directly in the individual or in the program. If one of your subject matter experts reaches out to a professional influencer and says, hey, you know, we're going to create some great content next Wednesday, would you be part of the conversation? It's not a, hey, I'm going to charge you some money. It's like, would I like to be part of that conversation? So I think agencies are, you know, have a place, but I think it does power that pay to play. And I think what is interesting in terms of our resourcing and, you know, a lot of the tech layoffs recently is that when there's minimal resources in-house, my fear is that more and more stuff goes through agencies or outsource and people just pay to play because it's easier. You know, I'll pay you $10,000. These are the messages that I want. Yeah, I'll give you some creative freedom, but can you make sure that you deliver these kind of leads? And sometimes it doesn't have that sort of in-house creativity and community where you can link it up to other programs. So I think that is a very true statement. But actually, culturally, I just felt that, especially 6 or 7 years ago when I was having this conversation, then everyone in Europe didn't want to pay influencers apart from, you know, the people that were paying for event speakers or the real sort of premium professional influencers. And everyone I was speaking to in the US didn't believe that you can engage people organically.
Interesting. Because of American culture and what have you. Yeah, it's definitely fascinating. And it brings another point that I want to ask you about. So I work with a lot of, I'm also a fractional CMO. I tend to work more with like startups and small businesses. So they're not the Ciscos, they're not the SAPs, they're not well known. And you made this point that it depends on who is reaching out to the influencer that influences how they respond and if they ask for money or not and how much money they ask for. And I agree wholeheartedly. And I wrote in The Age of Influence, one of the final chapters is why your brand should try to become a more influential entity, because the more perceived influence your brand has, when you reach out to said influencer, if they've never heard of you, they're going to react differently. So you're the startup with, you know, 100 followers on Twitter reaching out to someone, or you're the startup that has a little bit more following. You've already worked with other, you know, influencers. You have customers talking about you. You're republishing user-generated content. So I'm curious as to, is that something that you, when working with smaller businesses as well, is this something that is talked about or that you consult with businesses on?
Yeah, it exactly is. And I would relate it to my own story. I mean, when we first started and no one knew who we were, then obviously you can't, you know, go out and say, hey, would you like to create some content for me? Because nobody knows who you are. So why would they do that?
Yeah.
So if you're starting out, and what we did is we just identified who were the top, you know, 200 voices in the industry and created content which promoted them, because they of course want to promote, you know, themselves individually. And once you get, you know, 20 names on some great content, then they want to be part of that because there's FOMO and they don't want to miss out. And so to start with, when you are a startup, you've either got to pay if you don't have a brand and to say, here's what we're trying to do, and the influencers have to buy into that mission and that purpose. Or you need to really start creating the community and start creating recognition content that is valuable thought leadership material. So maybe you're great at creating social media content, or you're great at making people look good. And so you can combine some of the sort of secondary research out there to just create the best asset on the internet for whatever the topic is that you care about and the influencers care about. And so you can find your intersection. If you're an amazing brand that influencers just really want to work with, then they'll probably work with you organically for the first couple of times because they want to get in there with your brand. So when we talk to professional creators, sometimes they say, I'm working with these 20 brands, but I'd really like to get into these five. And obviously, if those five brands knew that they were wanting to get into, then they could quite easily leverage those influencers. So sometimes it's a matchmaking exercise, but I think as a brand, you have to have something. You know, it could be money, but influencers obviously care about their audience, so it's not just about the money. But I think some tech companies and some companies that had Chinese HQ as well, you were paying you know, better money than some of the US tech companies. And I knew a lot of influencers that just got flown over to lots of different events and then were sort of tweeting in different languages just about what they saw. And they were earning a lot of money, you know, for that. And then they were building brand affinity while they were there, but they were there initially because they got a big paycheck. So, you know, I'm not recommending that that's the best way to do it. And obviously they built that brand affinity over time, but it's either got to be money, it's got to be social purpose or recognition content, or like you say, you've got to build up that brand first to earn the right to earn with to work with content creators. But I think that there's always an influencer for you. You just might not be able to access the premium influencer when you're starting out, right? You know, so
yeah.
So building up to that stage.
I love that idea of recognition content, because this is something I always say the easiest way to start on an influencer marketing journey is curating the content of influencers. And if you can now include them as part of your content, you're now beginning this culture of, you know, of influencer marketing, of always thinking, who else can we include in the content? Are they external influencers? Are they executives? Are they employees, right? And really start to get everyone involved in a very, very easy and organic way. So I thought that was great advice. And yeah, for all those brands out there, it's like same thing with, you know, my students in my class. For a final project, they have to create an influencer marketing strategy. And I say, look, you cannot pick more than one influencer that they're all mainly B2C. You cannot pick more than one influencer that has over 100,000 followers. Because the fact of the matter is, you're going to try to reach out to all these celebrities and no one's going to give you the time of day. And if they do, you're not going to have the budget. So there is a little bit of realism. But as you said, there is an influencer every brand. And if you can't start externally, you can start internally if you have a little bit of budget. And I think, you know, Tim, I wanted to really close the conversation with, you know, measuring success and ROI. And, you know, I would say just like social media 10 years ago, we were asking what the ROI was. We don't ask it anymore. This concept of you know, owned, paid, and earned has been around. But I think earned really is that influencer marketing piece. And when you put a budget behind it, similar to how you have with paid and owned, and you're measuring the same things, you can begin to make sense, right, as to what, you know, what you're gaining from it, how much you should be investing. But I'm also curious as to, and therefore we don't ask anymore about the ROI of influencer marketing. It's something that's always on, something that we do. And I'm sure, you know, companies that are sponsoring our, you know, the next event like SAP truly understand that. But I'm curious, Tim, from your perspective, do you also see that evolution over time? Or do you think at the very beginning, companies just need to be able to measure, you know, every little cent, every little activity in order to create a story that says, hey, this is something we should invest more in? What's sort of the reality of the measurement today?
Yeah, a lot of companies are doing this and always on a basis. I think when we survey the B2B marketing professionals, then every single year people are investing more money in influencer marketing. And I think over the past 12 months, it's become something that people think is just what you need to do rather than, you know, maybe a nice to have. So that really has changed over the past 12 months. That's helped the ROI argument because, you know, I recall what's the ROI of social media in 2006, 2007. It was such an irritating question to get when, you know, because you just realized that the person didn't have a clue what the power was. It was just, you know, almost like, if you don't get it, then let's just speak to people that are moving, you know, with the times.
It's sort of like the congressional hearings and TikTok and some of the things you hear come out of that. But anyway, I digress. Sorry about that.
It's a very good question because people are still trying to measure influencer marketing and figure out how to do it. And a lot of people are doing it in likes or comments and saying, I work with that influencer, you know, they got 100 likes or some comments, you know, is this a good return on that investment? And I think if you're just creating one piece of content with one or two posts and you're looking at likes and comments and budget, then I don't think you're really capturing the true essence of what an influencer marketing program is. So some companies that start off very, very small and they activate one or two influencers, create this typically so video interview or you know, some kind of hero content that they repurpose the content as well. You know, there's some kind of impact there. But if you're able to create that and to create different assets and to build it into your always on marketing activity, then it can drive lots of different impact and you'll get a much greater ROI. So I think there's still a lot of maturity needed for the conversation. But I think in in B2B tech and professional services, especially, there's a lot more mature conversations there. I think with the heavily regulated industries, sometimes it's hard to get the multiple social assets out. Sometimes you're creating one or two social assets and they're saying, you did that do anything for me as a brand, as the sort of marketing spokesperson. And I think that that's where the culture and the senior management really need to try and evolve to be able to support programs so that they're not just seen on like a 3-month ROI. I give Ivanti, one of our customers, as an example here. Jeff Abbott, the CEO there, really evangelizes this kind of activity. He's very, very social. He's on social media, driving engagement with employees. He really, really gets it. And so they're able to do really cool stuff without having to sort of drive that ROI in terms of leads all the time. Now, of course, they've got, ROI metrics like brand share of voice, and they're sort of tracking that, to see how that's driving demand gen in some capacity. But there's not that too much pressure on has this one piece of content achieved something in 4 weeks, which I think like B2C could operate like that. We activated 15 influencers. Which one got us the most product sales? This one didn't do too much, so we're going to drop them next campaign. I think it's really important to not fall into the same trap and to look at this as a more of a longer term exercise.
Yeah. It's funny. I was on a SCM Rush webinar yesterday. It was like the CMO roundtable, and we were talking, recession coming and, people tightening marketing budgets, and sort of the same conversation. I actually started my career in finance. I worked in finance for a semiconductor manufacturer in Kyoto, Japan, go figure. But every year we had these hearings and we grilled every department as to what did they spend last year? What do they plan to spend this year? And why does every yen matter? And I think it's that same mindset, Tim, with marketing, whether it's influencer or content or social or digital. There are still companies. I did a speech or a workshop for one of these big pharmaceutical companies. And I'm like, well, no one asked what's the ROI of a website, right? And someone raised their hand and said, no, my boss actually asked, what is the ROI of our website development? So, at the end of the day, everything has to have a role in that customer, that prospect's journey. And if it influences, whether it's top or middle or bottom, whatever number you use, if you can architect your program, and this is, the way that I think you'd be successful on this is, if you architect your program in a way that makes it easy to measure, and what you're trying to get at is what you're trying to do with every other marketing program you have, then it becomes just very natural that you're going to be able to measure it and you're going to be able to talk about the ROI. So I think that too many companies have this siloed approach instead of a very holistic approach, right? Because it's just one other way of moving the needle forward on everything else you're doing in marketing, right?
Exactly. So pick 1 to 3 metrics, but the mature customers are really connecting some of those metrics to the other business outcomes that they care about internally. So I think you're totally right. But pick some metrics which you can use to appraise other activities as well, so that your great example of looking at influence marketing is earned, and then looking at how you invest in owned and paid, and also how you create content in terms of research or brand generated content. I think that's a really good way to measure the effectiveness of it. A very simple tactic is to look at the audience of your brand channels and look at the audience of your employee channels and just see which one is greater, which one's driving most engagement. And sometimes simple things like that are the ones that convince the senior management, because they totally get it.
Awesome. This has been an amazing conversation, Tim. So we are talking now, this is going out in a podcast. But the reason I want to include this information in the podcast, obviously for those that are listening right away, they have the ability to act. But even in the future, I know that your marketing is always on. And I know that you'll be back again and you'll be doing more of these events. But one of the things I love, Tim, about Analytica is, for those that are listening, it's like, well, if I really want to get involved in this, if I want to represent my brand and really get going in B2B influence marketing, where do I start? Is that now, Tim, you've launched these events and you're bringing together experts, both external experts, internal experts, people that are running these programs. I was honored to be part of your event in London. And I know just next month, and I'll throw up Ashley's comment here, that you're going to be doing this again in San Francisco. So I'll be actually driving up from Orange County, California. If anyone wants to do carpool karaoke video session in San Francisco, let me know. I'm up for the challenge. But Tim, I want to give you a chance to just sort of introduce, this event. I mean, why did you do it? That first one in London, and then what's going on in San Francisco in April?
Yeah, it's just about community. I mean, I talked about community at the beginning of this. We want to practice what we preach. You know, our influencers are, you know, our customers, industry experts, influencers, and also they need to know each other, right? You know, they spend a lot of time talking to us, saying we'd love to meet, you know, content creators, and would love to speak to peers and network with other people. There aren't too many events, you know, focused on B2B influencer marketing. There are your parts, you know, of other events of B2B marketing that are dedicated to influencer marketing, but we just wanted to be that community that brought everyone together. So typically there are anywhere from like 50 to 150 people, and there's always an amazing caliber of person, and we have a great time and a lot of learnings and fun. So it's a pleasure for us to be able to bring everyone together, and we definitely learn a lot from it as well.
So once again, to make this completely accessible, it'll be in the show notes, the link, but if you're listening and it's like, I want to get to San Francisco, I want to be part of this event, it is coming up April 19th. Go to this URL, Analytica. You should know how to spell it, but just in case, onalytica.com/B2B-influencer-marketing-summit. I will be there. Tim will be there. A lot of really amazing folks are going to be there. There's already this buzz that I see in LinkedIn comments of people really excited for this event. And it's only a half-day event. Obviously, there will be networking before and after, but it really is going to be an incredible opportunity to learn at an even deeper level, get connected, whether it is with other industry experts or even begin relationships with external influencers. It is going to be the center of the B2B influencer marketing universe. So make sure that you're there. Tim, outside of that event, where else can people go and find out more about you and Analytica?
Please find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm on Twitter, it's @WilliamsTim. LinkedIn, if you just put in Tim Williams and Analytica, that's the best way you can find me, since Williams is a very common surname. So don't just put in Tim Williams, otherwise you'll never find me. On our website, obviously analytica.com, there's a lot of thought leadership material there. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, Neil, and thank you so much. And I'm pumped to see you next month at our event.
And my apologies, Tim. Like, this live stream and everybody who listens to my podcast know is something I only recently started doing. So I'm giving a 1 minute, like, really passionate talk, and the video is just full screen, Tim. So my apologies there. You're probably wondering what's going on, Neil, but my bad. But it's all good. And actually, those bloopers become the best content, don't they?
Right. It becomes much more real.
Indeed, indeed. Authenticity. All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. If you are new here, I do half interviews, half solo episodes. It's all about digital content, influencer, social media marketing. There is a lot to cover. As your digital marketing coach, it is my responsibility to cover this and to provide you when and where I see the best advice is. If you've been a listener, would you do me a favor and, well, I assume you're already subscribing, but go into your podcast app, you know, a 5-star, a little comment, a little thumbs up, anything you can do to help share this podcast with the world would mean the world to me. All right, everybody, that's it for another exciting episode of the Your Digital Marketing Coach podcast. This is your digital marketing coach, Neil Schaefer, signing off.
You've been listening to Your Digital Marketing Coach. Questions, comments, requests, links, go to podcast.neilschaefer.com. Get the show notes to this and 200 plus podcast episodes and neilschaefer.com to tap into the 400 plus blog posts that Neil has published to support your business. While you're there, check out Neil's Digital First Group Coaching Membership Community if you or your business needs a little helping hand. See you next time on Your Digital Marketing Coach.